Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. And tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from my lair in Old Thornhill Village just north of Toronto. Tonight, the music, mysticism, spirituality, and culture of the 1960s. No decade in modern history has generated more controversy and divisiveness than the tumultuous 1960s. For some, the 60s were an era of free love, drugs, and social revolution. For others, the 60s were an ungodly rejection of all that was good and holy, embarking on a profound search for the spiritual meaning behind the massive social upheavals of the 1960s, British scholar of esoteric movements, Tobias Churton, turns a kaleidoscopic lens on religious and esoteric history, industry, science, philosophy, art, and social revolution to identify the meaning behind all of these diverse moments. So, we will get to Tobias Churton in hour two of the program. And the first hour, we're gonna do some open lines, which is kind of a refreshing change on a Saturday. So again, tonight on Coast, we take a long look at the 1960s. And to quote a lyric from the Grateful Dead song Truckin', what a long, strange trip it's been. You could say that about the 60s. You could also say the same thing about Coast to Coast AM, I suppose. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Hey, and welcome back. And yes, we are doing open lines for the first hour, and then in the second hour, we may do 2 hours, we may do 3 hours with Tobias Churton. He's a world authority on Gnosticism, Hermeticism, Freemasonry, and Rosicrucianism. And we'll be talking about the spiritual meaning of the 60s, the magic, the myth, and music of the decade that changed the world. And I think I've got some pretty nice bumper music for you tonight as well as we take a look at the 1960s. And, you know, for open lines, we're going to keep it political free zone. No politics, no COVID. Maybe we can talk about the music of the 1960s. Maybe we could talk about brushes with greatness. Maybe you've had an encounter with a favorite, a pleasant encounter with a famous musician from the 1960s. Hopefully also hear from Chris Hill. Chris Hill is a music critic, and we were supposed to have Chris in the first hour to talk about the music of the 1960s as well. And, you know, that's the way live radio goes sometimes. Chris isn't where he's supposed to be right now. So maybe we'll hear from Chris Hill a little bit later, the author of Into the Mystic, or maybe we won't. And if that's the case, we'll just forge ahead as we always do in live radio. All right. The other thing that we could talk about is as we roll into an open line segment here, just for an hour, we can talk about your recent encounters with the paranormal or UFOs. And of course, also tomorrow, or a little bit later today, actually, for some of you on the West Coast, it's Easter Sunday. Easter Sunday, of course, the resurrection. So maybe we could also talk about miracles. Easter miracles, or miracles that occur at any time of the year, because this is, of course, a time of miracles on the Christian calendar. Now, I'm Eastern Orthodox, so my Easter is in several weeks. But, of course, the world's billions of Christians, Catholics, and other denominations are celebrating Christmas, or Christmas, celebrating Easter this week. So if you have a remarkable miracle you'd like to share with us, then we'll open the lines available to you as well. We've got the wild card lines available, international, east, west, you know the drill, first-time callers. And why don't we begin with some miracle stories? That would be great. You know, something interesting happened to me today. I have a photograph of my father from the Second World War, and he's wearing his uniform. It's a black and white photo. It was taken. He was probably, I'm guessing, maybe 19 at the time. And one of my sons found an app that will take that photograph and colorize it and animate it. Have you seen this? Maybe you've already seen this app. This was new to me. So this photograph of my father, now he would be 98 if he were alive today. He passed away back in 1986. He's been gone a very long time. But this photograph, he's wearing his uniform, his beret. He's got his cap badge from Fort Garry Horse, which was an armored regiment out of Winnipeg. He's got his, I guess you would call it his tunic. And he's got kind of a pencil-thin mustache. He looked a little bit like Errol Flynn. Anyway, my son surprised me with this, and he sent me this picture. Now it's fully colorized, and there's a sparkle in my father's eyes that I hadn't seen in the black and white photo. It comes to life, and then it's actually animated. My father's, this photograph of my father, it starts to move. My father is smiling. He's blinking. He's looking around. And my first impression was, that's a little unsettling. That's a little disturbing to see my father sort of come to life that way. But then I looked at it several more times, and those initial feelings of, I don't know, being a little weirded out, they went away. And I felt like my father was here again. It was wonderful. All right. If you've heard about this app, I'd love to hear from you. If you've had an experience with it, let's say hi to Todd on the wildcard line. Todd's in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Todd, welcome.
Hi, Richard. Thank you. Please do me a big favor and don't play the Bump in the Night song anymore, Crazy in the Night. Anna, I wanted to ask you, like, out of all the...
Well, hang on, let me stop you there, Todd. That's my kind of, that's my end signature song. I've been playing it for like 6 years. That's just the way I close out the show. That's the way I do it. And I'm sorry if you don't like the song, but I'm going to keep playing it.
Okay, so out of hundreds and hundreds of songs, you know, you guys have to pick from, how do you choose what you want to play?
Just whatever inspires me, whatever moves me, whatever makes me feel good.
So, Google songs like, you know, what I do is I'll Google like 1959, and you know, there's so many songs that I never played, right, from any single year. Like, do you ever say, I want to play, you know, like Marilyn McCoo or you know, like somebody like
that? Sometimes what I'll do, Todd, is rather than play maybe the obvious song from a particular band, I might, like, you know, go into the kind of go, you know, deep into their catalog and find something that you wouldn't normally hear. Let's say from, you know, rather than playing Let It Be or Hey Jude by the Beatles, something that maybe is a little more obscure. People have heard it, but they haven't heard it in a while. I try to throw one of those chestnuts in there once in a while, too.
With the band, the Stampeders from Canada, you know, they had that big hit, like, Sweet City Woman. It'd be interesting
That's
to
right.
find out if they had anything heavier, you know.
Well, they also had a song, I believe it was by the Stampeders, called Green-Eyed Lady, which is a good track as well. Do you know that one?
Uh-huh.
All right. Okay, Todd, thanks so much for the call. Let's say hi next to Brent. Brent is in Bakersfield this evening. Hello, Brent. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Excellent. Excellent. What I have is, I have quite a few gifts that God has given me, but one that I wanted to cover tonight is an event that happened with audio clairvoyance, being able to speak to those that have left this earthly realm. And know if you're familiar with where
who do you speak to?
Is, but it's in the Central Valley of California, and it's
yes.
Okay, it's in the more southern end, and where I was headed to is Fresno, which is about 120 miles north of Bakersfield, and about halfway along the route up 99, I need to answer Mother Nature, so I pulled off in 99. I got up on a side road, then I turned onto another side road, and found myself in an area that was, it wasn't being farmed, and there weren't any houses there. It was kind of a barren area, except for this one large tree. And by this one large tree, there was a broken down corner of this building. Leftover brick that is probably, 100 years old or so. It was quite weathered. And I stopped there and was doing my business when I received a voice. And it asked me a question, which I'm quite familiar in getting, is, can you hear me? And I said, yes. And they were quite surprised by that, by my answer. And the next thing I knew, there was a whole group of people that were excitedly trying to communicate with me all at once. Well, I can't see these people. All I can do is hear them. And it was like, well, you know, let me finish up here, and I'll try and figure out what the heck is going on. This is just, to me, it's an extraordinary tale. What had happened was that this group of people had come across a berry bush that was like, second or third generation, I guess. There had been a parent bush that had put out feelers, and the parent bush died, and the feelers kind of made like a donut shape, except for this one opening. And the berries inside of this opening were just apparently extraordinary, really tasty, and had attracted all these different people. The only thing was that somewhere laying in wait outside of this donut, with this one entrance into this donut, and apparently the berry bush was about 5-6 feet high and quite thorny, and not something that you'd want to try and climb over. There was a bear that used this bush, this donut, as a trap. And over the years, this bear had killed all of these people.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah, it was something that I was not even expecting, you know, just. And I.
So everybody that reached out to you from the other side had been mauled by this bear.
Well, in this group, yes, that morning.
Right. Yeah. And how many were there? How many individuals were there?
One of them had said something like 18. Dude had apparently been there for like 150 years trying to reach out to anybody that could hear him, and they never had any success until they came across me. And I have a guardian angel which was able to help them move on past that point. But I just found that to be just so bizarre and amazing.
So they were waiting around for about 150 years someone was able to communicate with them.
I guess the one individual had been there that long. I don't know that all of them had been there that long. But
if they had all been killed by the same bear, it would stand to reason that, let's say, I don't know, how long does a bear live? 20 years?
I don't know. But, yeah, I imagine it was probably about the same amount of time. And I seem to have the older bears that have trouble, you know, hunting deer and stuff that would resort to eating humans. So, I don't know, maybe he was on his way out and found an easy way of attracting or finding victims or prey.
Well, Brent, that's a remarkable story. And was that the first time that happened to you when you realized you had this ability?
Oh, no. I started when I was about 5 years old. I'm 65 now. Uh-huh. So I've been doing it for a while.
Right, right. Brent, thank you for sharing. Fascinating.
Sure thing.
All right, let's say hi to Nicholas is a first-time caller calling in from Colorado Springs. Hello, Nicholas. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad, thanks.
And good. No, this is awesome to be a first-time caller here on Coast to Coast. And the gentleman before me, he had a pretty interesting story that I guess him and I could kind of see eye to eye. Maybe where we go with this. I thought it would be a kind of dream.
Nicholas, your phone is kind of coming in and out. It's very difficult to understand you. Can you hold the phone up to your mouth a little closer, please?
Is that better?
That's much better. Go ahead.
All right. So I've had a recurring dream my whole life. Probably with the time I've had it about five.
Okay, there it goes again. Nicholas, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to let you go. The phone quality simply isn't there. I don't know if you're on a cell or what's happening. But all right, let's say hi to Matt in North Carolina on the wild card line. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Richard. I was going to tell you a story about a place I went earlier this week called Judicola Rock. Have you ever heard of it?
Judicola Rock. Aside from it being in North Carolina,
yes.
You don't. Okay, tell me about it.
It's an ancient petroglyph in the middle of nowhere, and it's basically a big mystery. It's considered a Cherokee heritage site, but a lot of people are seeming to think that it predates the Cherokee in the area. And it's one of the largest on the East Coast, and they don't know, you know, what it means, who did it, and why.
And what is it? What does it look like, this petroglyph?
Well, it's a huge rock, and it has a lot of different symbols on it, and maybe possibly even like animals, just different symbols and different things that, you know, it's really hard to pick out. What each symbol on it means. Some people think it was possibly like an ancient hunting map or something like that, or, you know, maybe something that the people that carved it saw in the sky or something like that. They just don't really know. But you can find look it up online. It's just kind of a neat thing because it's so large. You know, there's a few on the East Coast, but nothing of that size.
Judicola Rock. All right. Well, next time I'm in North Carolina, I've been there. It's a beautiful state. I will search it out, Matt. Thank you for that. Let's see. We've got Larry in Sedona, Arizona. Larry, we've got time for a quick call here. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. My name's Blair, and I used to work at the Cow Palace back and when Bill Graham's office was still alive and well, and I drive into there and pick up tickets for concerts. I was thinking of the Motor City Madman, Ted Nugent, back when I was 1980. It wasn't the 60s, but basically he was jamming when Cat Scratch Fever was a big tune. I don't know if you were a fan of that kind of music there, Richard.
Well, I don't mind some Ted Nugent if I'm in the right mood.
Yeah. Well, I also saw Paul McCartney there, too, in 76 with Wings, and it was a nice balancing act. But, you know, think of Santana, Sly and the Family Stone, Creedence Clearwater Revival, The Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin.
Wow.
Joplin.
You saw all of them? You saw all of them at the Cow Palace?
No, these are all people that came to the Cow Palace and are all San Francisco.
Oh, sure.
And also the Chambers
Brothers.
Of
course,
of course. That group that does Time Has Come Today. It was all from San Francisco, a very, very fertile area. You know, there's a
absolutely
El Cerrito guy by the name of John Fogerty that I think sort of listens to this show, and
I've been told that he does. Yes. Yeah, John's been on the program with George Norrie.
You betcha. I saw the Tubes play. That was a group that was avant-garde. They did songs called "White Punks on Dope" and "What Do You Want from Life" at the Great American Music Hall. And Neil Sean.
I remember the Tubes. Yes, I remember the Tubes.
I beg your pardon?
I remember the Tubes. Absolutely. Listen, I got to run, Larry or Blair. Is it Blair or Larry?
It's Blair. That's cool.
Blair. All right. Thank you for checking in from Sedona. And we'll come back, take some more calls, maybe brushes with greatness, with musicians from the 60s or any decade, really. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Could future humans evolve to have venom glands? In new research, scientists close a long open door by casually linking early salivary glands with what eventually become venom glands in many animals. Can you imagine? Because saliva is the common thread, that means anyone with salivary glands could eventually develop venom, from mice in the new experiment all the way up to humans. You can read more in the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to Open Lines when we return right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back. Well, we have good news. Our scheduled guest has joined us, and now we're going to explore the visionary, mystical, and ecstatic traditions that influenced the music of the 1960s and musical artists like the Grateful Dead, the Beatles, Bob Dylan. And Christopher Hill is here. He's going to explain how the British invasion acted as the detonator to explode visionary music into the mainstream, and how 1960s rock and roll music transformed consciousness on both the individual and collective levels. Chris has written about rock and roll music in the pages of Spin, Record Magazine, International Musician, Chicago Magazine, Downbeat, Deep Roots Magazine, and other national and regional publications. His work has been anthologized in the Rolling Stone Record Review, and he's the author of Holidays and Holy Nights, and also Into the Mystic, the Visionary and Ecstatic Roots of 1960s Rock and Roll. Christopher Hill, welcome. How are you?
Well, I'm doing very well tonight. Thanks. I'm glad we could finally get together. I'm glad to have the chance to talk a little bit about one of the subjects I'm pretty passionate about, as you can probably guess from taking a look at my book. So,
absolutely, yes. Well, yeah. I think we share that passion of, well, I'd like to begin at the beginning if we could, because in the introduction you write about the 19th century French poet Arthur Rimbaud, and you write in the book, Rimbaud is one of the household deities of rock and roll. Like the family ghost, he pops up at significant junctures. So let's begin there. Who was Rimbaud, and why is it important to understand who he was in order to understand the music of the 1960s?
Well, he was a very unusual young Frenchman who kind of revolutionized poetry by the time he was 20. And never wrote another work of poetry after that time. And he sort of provided the model for the idea of the young person who has this intense vision of a sort of visionary art. He was very disappointed with the poetry and the literature of his day, and believed that you needed to sort of alter your vision in order to be a real artist. And a lot of people, like Jim Morrison, Patti Smith, Bob Dylan, have found a lot of inspiration in his career as someone who just had this intensity of desire to sort of push things ever farther and in his art and in his ability to open up his perception and his consciousness to a broader range of things that are usually something find their way into art that's accepted by the masses. And so he became sort of the model for a lot of these rock and rollers in the 60s of what an artist could be, what a rebel sort of artist could be, and what a very young person could bring to pushing the boundaries of their art ever further than it had been.
I guess
before.
I guess you could also throw William Blake in there too, as well, right?
Sure you could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Blake was definitely. Now he lived. He ended up living a much longer progressive life than productive life than Rambo did. But yeah, he was very much into the same kind of thing, and he believed in the expansion of ordinary human perception in the same way that Rambo did. Yeah.
So they both helped to inform this visionary art, this initiatory art that the 1960s really became all about. But there was something different, and another element added on top of that, which you write about, and that is this profound connection to African-American music and the spiritual tradition. So let's talk a little bit about that, this cultural cross-fertilization of the new, the white youth culture meeting the sacred music of the African diaspora.
Yeah, when the enslaved Africans were first brought to the New World, they brought with them, although it was in one sense it was very much suppressed by the slave owners. They brought with them aspects of their religions that they had practiced in Africa. And this had nothing to do. This was entirely separate from the European kind of tradition represented by guys like Blake or Rambo. But it did share with that the idea of trying to building into their practice and the science of reaching ecstatic levels of consciousness. And this was something that eventually, well, it's a very long story, but it worked itself by way of African-American music into the mainstream of American culture. Until by the 1950s, a whole lot of people, including a whole lot of white kids, were hearing and dancing to and purchasing music that essentially had its roots in this African-American ecstatic tradition. So what happened in the 60s is that you had these two very different traditions coming from extremely different worlds, kind of discovering each other, and there is a lot of power in that when they met, and the two forms of sort of reaching ecstasy through art came together, and it was a very potent kind of mixture when they discovered each other.
There's another quote in your book, Into the Mystic, and it's from Michael Ventura, from his book, Hear That Long Snake Moan. And he writes, "The voodoo rite of possession by the gods became the standard of American performance in rock and roll, which is not to say rock and roll is voodoo, but it does present qualities of that African metaphysics." So talk to me about how rock and roll performances, American performances in rock and roll, were like voodoo.
Well, American music, in one sense, American popular music has been said to have its origin in New Orleans, where elements of slave traditional religious practices, African-American traditional religious practices were first discovered by a mass American audience, and where what had been religious practices only became gradually modify themselves into popular music that little by little became a powerful force in itself in American popular music. And of course, the African American religions, among one of which was the Lulu tradition in New Orleans, which is often misunderstood a lot. It's surrounded by a lot of sort of kind of almost cartoonish sort of representation. A lot of these things were very powerful in the culture that originally enslaved Africans had created for themselves in the Americas. And there were, for instance, in Haiti, the secret voodoo societies among the slaves became very significant in creating the revolution that finally threw the French colonizers out of Haiti and achieved independence for them. And it was realized by American slave owners, by the great masters of the Cotton Kingdom in the southern United States, that this was potentially very dangerous to them. But anyway, the central practice of these African American spiritual traditions had to do with a state of trance or possession by the god, reaching a state of ecstasy. And eventually, this became a practice as the African American church became more organized and more successful after the liberation of the slaves, after the Civil War. It began to affect church culture, the culture of church music, in both black and white denominations in the United States. And so you get people like Elvis Presley on his famous 68 television special, when he came on and explained that rock and roll was nothing but gospel music, the kind of gospel music that he had grown up with in church, and this sort of performance of ecstasy on stage, originally from a pulpit and then later transferred to the stage, became one of the expectations of what you could expect to get out of this kind of music. And it gradually affected a whole lot of pop music. And this is to move our story forward considerably. But when these African-American-based musics got to the British Isles and were eventually adopted by young British musicians, that became part of their expectation of what you could derive from the music. So it had its roots in the culture of these African-American religions, like voodoo and other traditions, and it eventually became something that was felt in music that became extremely popular over the years.
Right, right.
And especially in the 60s.
I just want to go back to the African-American influence in rock and roll, and you talked about the African-American church and African-American Christianity, and there was something that they did. It was called the ring shout that was very important to the development of the music.
Yes.
Tell me about the ring shout.
Well, this was especially in the southern United States, became sort of the central part of the of the ritual and the worship as African American traditions became more and more Christianized, both before and after the Civil War. And it was, you could say, it's an early kind of rock and roll, because when you go back to music that became popular in the 50s in the United States, you can see how it has a direct connection to the ring shout, which was basically people dancing in a ring. That's what it meant. But they would act out, in their dance, they would act out these stories of liberation. They might act out the liberation of the Israelites from Egypt, and other stories that could have been seen as very subversive and dangerous by the slave owners. But it depended on rhythm, and it depended on the people who were doing it, who were involved in the ritual, upon a practice that involved the rhythm of the music and the dance and the often rather complex rhythmic things going on, especially when you consider that they didn't have any instruments. So they would have to provide sort of their own percussion by slapping.
All right, Christopher, I'm going to just jump in here because we're going to we're approaching the bottom of the hour, or sorry, the top of the hour. We'll come back. We'll talk about the British invasion and why it was, as you say, the detonator of the 1960s. Christopher Hill, Into the Mystic, the Visionary, and Ecstatic Roots of the 1960s Rock and Roll. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM.